This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell.
Just a quick warning. Two subjects really get me going. Politicians who climb on the back of the poor and, when it suits them, of course, for political advantage, along with a lazy media unwilling to question the self-serving virtue signaling and ignore the litany of examples where their self-proclaimed political champions of the poor have supported legislation that definitely hurts them. By the way, the right also supports legislation that hurts the poor, but they're not the ones standing on a soapbox claiming to be the champions of the downtrodden. And by the way, I am happy to debate at any time any politician who disagrees with that. I think the over-under on that was 2 minutes, as in it will take me less than 2 minutes to expose their hypocrisy and shallowness. But the other subject I want to talk about today that really winds me up is using children for political gain. It's the Western version of the child soldier. Children are put front and center to essentially be parrots for the adults that are charged with their care, which brings me to the repugnant example of 16-year-old Swedish high school student Greta Thunberg, who earlier this year gained notoriety for organizing a student protest over the lack of action on climate change. She's being paraded around the globe as a chief spokesperson on what she says is an imminent climate catastrophe. Ms. Thunberg recently won up, by the way, the climate alarmist that falsely stated that the recent International Panel on Climate Change report concluded we have only 12 years left to live to avoid Armageddon. By the way, widely reported, but not true. By the way, did you know that? All the talk, including by Environment Minister McKenna, of the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change saying we have till only 2030, is incorrect. It's not true. But no matter, because Greta Thunberg has cut that number by more than half, stating in quotes that if we fail to start the rapid transformation of our society within the upcoming 5 years, then basically nothing else will matter in the future. Of course, she failed to provide any evidence or research to support that claim. But that's okay, because she's a child. And it certainly pleases the activists and politicians who use her. And use her is the right word. There is something so creepy about these grown men and women surrounding a young girl who suffers from depression and Asperger's syndrome, being trotted out for photo ops to advance the career of salivating politicians and fundraising climate activists. Creepy people who I wouldn't let within a mile of my children. You think I'm wrong? Well, then I got a question for you. How long do you think she'd be the darling of the climate set if she dared stray one iota from the climate alarmist agenda? The climate crowd doesn't love her for who she is. It's for what she says. She's not the new mascot of the climate crowd because she's done extensive research, because she's got something to add to the scientific understanding of climate change. No, she's there because she's a child who can garner media attention and spouts the extremist agenda. The latest publicity stunt, organized by adults, creepy men are the word that keep coming to my mind, is Greta crossing the Atlantic on a multi-million dollar zero carbon emissions racing sailboat in order to join the climate protests in New York in late September and speak at a climate action summit hosted by the UN chief Antonio Guterres. The Telegraph opinion writer Sherelle Jacobs, I thought, summed this up beautifully, stating, "This latest venture, which vulgarly combines super-rich lifestyle advertising with the impotent modern activist weakness for pointless stunts, only highlights further the campaigners can offer us no practical solutions." Well, appearing alongside the UN chief will afford Ms. Thunberg the chance to make more statements of imminent catastrophe without a whiff of supporting research, while advocates get their photo ops. I can't help but wish the UN chief would get Mrs. Wilson's grade 7 class from PS 149 to lecture us on the Ebola breakout in the Congo or the escalating cancer scare in Kenya. Of course, that's laughable. We have scientists who spent their adult life studying subjects like climate change, but it's a 16-year-old girl who gets the media spotlight. That does not reflect well on the media. But that spotlight is contingent, and this is the more important point, is contingent on her parroting the alarmist line on climate change. I mean, God help her if she should start thinking critically and question even the smallest tenet of the alarmist doctrine. The affection and attention would evaporate immediately. I just wonder about the psychological damage that would do to her. That may never happen, but at some point, she will be yesterday's news, no longer the media darling of the alarmist set. Come on, there's lots of outspoken climate alarmists, but they don't get the coverage Greta Thunberg does because she's a curiosity, because she's a child who organized a high school protest that went viral. Well, that's going to get old soon. The media's going to get bored of that one. If she had been an adult organizing that same protest, there'd be no media frenzy. and I see no sign that anyone has given a thought to her emotional and psychological well-being when she's no longer the flavor of the day, despite the fact that the risks are real for any teenager, let alone one that suffers from depression and Asperger's. One final note, not to be overlooked. As famed economist Thomas Sowell said, we have kids in elementary school who are being urged to take stands on political issues, to write letters to congressmen and presidents about nuclear energy. They're not a decade old, and they're being thrown these kinds of questions that can absorb the lifetime of a very, very brilliant and learned man. And they're being taught that it's important to have views, but they are not being taught that it's important to know what you're talking about. Michael Levy joins me on the line right now. Mike, you know, one of the things I love to talk about, and I know you do too, is the massive technological change. It's sort of sci-fi interest, you know, the same thing like the Jetsons are real today, that kind of, I mean, you know, here we are, video phones is commonplace, but when we were kids, that was a dream. But how much of that's coming to fruition? But the other is how important it is economically to understand what's going on technologically. And I'll just give you an example. I wanted you to comment on it. I'm looking at how much money the Canadian banks are spending on technological sort of development, upgrades, innovation, and I get the impression they're still playing catch up big time.
Well, they are, Mike, and you know, the number is actually, you take a step back and say, wow, but looking at a column in the Globe and Mail this week, just an excellent column on the change in banking and the threat of digital disruption. Well, the Royal Bank spends about $3 billion a year on technology and just learning and just trying to applying the new technology to the banking business. And this happened, Mike, just let me give you a brief background, is they were in China taking a look at what was going on there, and they discovered WeChat, that popular messaging app, and it lets users make payments, transfer money, book flights, hail ride sharing, order food delivery, and all from a mobile phone, and they collect the customer data and then are able to forecast, predict, and sell what these customers want, how they want it, how they want it delivered. And Mike, it's the threat of a huge digital disruption, and it's going to hit the banking industry, big time, Canadian banks, and even more so U.S. banks. But the Royal has done a huge study on this, and they are plowing forward, and I mean just going forward without hesitation to be ahead of the curve.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, we all, you know, we talked about online banking going back several years, and you sort of didn't trust it and all that stuff. I can't even remember the last time I went to a bank, if you know what I mean, you know, and the range of services now are growing. And then you get stuff like Apple Pay, and I know it hasn't been that fast to catch on, but come on, Apple ain't going anywhere. I just love that these major companies are spending so much money, and it's great that Canadian banks are sort of, wow, this is a real threat to our profitability, to our customer base.
Well, it really is, Mike. And when you take a look at how the banks, and everybody will remember this, including the millennial generation, is when your mailbox was filled with credit card applications from every different bank, every different credit card company. Side note here, we don't get any at all. I mean, there is nothing comes by mail to ask us. But in the United States, where we go sometimes in the winter, our mailbox is filled from the Capital One, Chase, the different banks wanting you to sign up for their credit cards. The banks used to use mass mailings. They don't do that anymore. They used to want to lure customers into their branch so they could sell them a mortgage. There was always the mutual fund salesman in the branch. They wanted to do all your banking by getting you into the branch. And now they don't even want you to step foot in the branch because everything is turning digital. They're going to less branches, more online, and they want to be, as I say, the Royal, but all the other banks want to be there as things change.
And it's going to be a big change. I mean, we know now online mortgages, for example, would have been quite a mind blower 5 years ago. But it's also, I think the other thing that you've said, Mike, is that we're watching these big companies like Amazon or Apple or Google get into this space. They may be niche players are taking on it, like a mortgage, Rocket Mortgage, for example. But man, it is a very competitive space right now.
Well, it is, Mike. And I mean, you'll be able to, you can do it right now. Go ask Alexa or your Google HomePlay, what's the best mortgage rate? And if they can't do it today, they're going to tell you 90 days from now when that app is up and running. Well, the scarier part of this, it's not scary really, but the intriguing part of this is they will go out and find what you want online. And the minute that they, and we talked about this last week and the week before, the way they gather your information, they will take what you want and they might go out and sell it to the highest bidder. And all of a sudden you're going to get a message, email, messaging, but you're going to get a message about here's what you want, here's what we can offer you, and let's do it. And boy, just take a step back and think of where does that put the banks unless they're doing exactly the same thing?
Yeah, it's going to be, it's just such an amazing environment, and it's a good taste of the kinds of things that it's going to change. Our behavior is going to push their behavior, get new products, new services. It's going to be the works. I think I've got enough to think about for the weekend. Mike, you go out and enjoy yours.
Well, you too, Mike. Have a good weekend.
Time now for the big fat idea. You know, since it was March 2009 when on Money Talks we first turned bullish, especially on the U.S. stock market. I'm still bullish on the U.S. stock market long term. But lately I've been talking about the storm clouds for the fall, and you have to sit back and you have to say to yourself, can I afford the kind of drop that we saw last November, December? Because I think the potential is there. That's why I was pleased to get Andrew Rulin coming on the show with me today. Andrew, first of all, you know, my biggest worry about people is that they're complacent. I just don't, you know, and again, this is just my take. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I don't think being complacent in this environment, when I see a building monetary crisis, when you see things like the trade war escalate this past week, you know, a lot of factors are out there that are obvious. And at some point, it may catch up to the market. I suspect it will. But, in the, you know, I just know, one of the things I know is you can't be complacent about it.
Absolutely. And I mean, when I think all the way back to late 2007, listening to Bob Hoy come on Money Talk, yep, and talk about the credit bubble, and then reading Jim Dines' newsletter where he picked up on the looming recession in the U.S. Mere weeks after it had actually set in. You know, these prescient warnings that that you brought to Money Talks listeners didn't help most people, and I think for a couple of reasons. First, people didn't know how to protect their portfolio, but the second part is neither did their financial advisors. You know, life is busy. You know, we're dealing with work, we're dealing with personal relationships, home life, our health, all those different sorts of things. And so when things are kind of moving along somewhat smoothly, it slips to the back of our mind and we do become complacent. And so we become vulnerable to the risks that are out there. And we're also in a position where we're not able to position ourselves for emerging opportunities because we're just not thinking about it.
I'm talking with Andrew Rulin. He's president, Integrated Wealth Management in Calgary. Andrew, well, let's start with, you know, pretend I'm one of your clients and say, okay, what should we be doing? I mean, at the very least, it would seem to me, I come in, I take the time, if you know, and I know you'd make the time for me, you would take the time, and let's go over the risk we're taking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One of the concepts that we always look at is understand what your financial pain threshold is, really, in terms of how much downside volatility you can take. And that's in what I would call kind of normal course volatility. So like what happened in the fourth quarter last year, where equity markets fell by 20% or more, and our client portfolios fell between 4 and 6. So that's kind of normal course, financial pain threshold stuff. But beyond that, you also need to have a clearly articulated financial safety plan. So how will you, if you're self-managing, or how will your financial advisor, if your money is managed by someone else, how exactly are you prepared to manage against catastrophic risk?
That's music to my ears. First of all, think about that from a cost-benefit analysis. It doesn't cost anything. Take a little time, be reassured, be proactive, because I think that kind of decline we saw in November, December was a real taste of the level of volatility we're experiencing. And I might add, on Money Talks, we talked about that not being like the big all-time decline. We said stay in the market, and we were lucky enough. I was talking to my friend Martin Armstrong, who literally picked the day of the low. I think it was December 26th off the top of my head. So we were on that, but it's still uncomfortable. And people have to know, and I love that what you just said is, you know, what's your sort of psychological risk pain threshold? That is something we all have to be aware of. I mean, I've blown tons of money, not because of the market, but I've made mistakes because of my risk threshold was too high. I went way above it is what I'm trying to say.
Well, exactly. And something that I've talked about in seminars and in meetings and on webinars is the fact that as humans, we're hardwired to really mess this up because we're hardwired to want to move towards euphoria and positive feelings like near a mass top in the markets. And we're psychologically driven to run away from fear and risk and negative emotion. And so when we're not yet at a top, we're, you know, in that complacency stage, we don't yet have that euphoria. But if you don't take advantage of the time between now and the massive top, you could be finding yourself in a position where the same thing happens to you now that happened to your portfolio 11 years ago.
Well, I think the other thing this is bringing to mind is your goal as an investor is not to take every last dime off the table. And this is a huge mistake Victor Adair talks to me about all the time, which is we are investors and we start thinking like traders, like I got to pick the bottom, I got to pick the top. Man, that's a recipe for disaster.
It is. It's perfectionism. And what people end up doing is they end up picking up dimes in front of bulldozers, and it's not smart. Now, if you've got a very disciplined framework, a very disciplined plan in terms of how you approach it, you can get a lot of the kind of the final upward surge until, you know, the greatest fool has bought the top for you. But you don't need to get it perfect. You don't need to sell the exact top or buy the exact bottom. You just need to get most of the meat in between.
Absolutely. Andrew Rulin can be found at integratedwealthmanagement.ca, integratedwealthmanagement.ca. As I say, take his advice. Go get your financial health checkup. Everybody does it. Good for you to be doing it. Andrew Rulin, President, Integrated Wealth Management. Thanks for finding time on the long weekend.
My pleasure, Mike. Take care.
That was great. That's great advice. I would really, gosh, I hope people take advantage of it, because what I see coming in terms of a monetary cycle is something that every one of us should be at least prepared for and aware of, and I can't be more clear than that. Oh, I nearly forgot to do my quote of the week here. I was going to, what the heck am I talking about here? Because I'm so looking forward to John Johnson, who's on deck here with me. But first, I think it's an especially appropriate quote of the week, given it's the Vancouver Pride Parade tomorrow. There's plenty of controversy surrounding the Pride Society's banning of the Vancouver Public Library and the University of British Columbia from participating. And by the way, let me repeat a challenge I made earlier this week. I will donate $500 to charity, the charity of their choice, of the first media person who can get the Prime Minister of Canada specifically to tell us what he thinks of excluding two public institutions from the parade because they rented room to two speakers that the Pride Society vehemently disagrees with. Now, given the federal government has committed hundreds of thousands of tax dollars to the Pride Society in an election year, and the Prime Minister is campaigning on the taxpayers' money, I think that's a legitimate question. What does he think of banning UBC and the Vancouver Public Library? You know what? I'm not going to do $500. I'll do $1,000, and believe me, I'm good for it. I will do $1,000 to any media person who can specifically get him not to ramble on, not to divert from the question. What does he think of banning UBC and the Vancouver Public Library? $1,000 right there. Now to the quote of the week. I mentioned last week that Jonathan Rauch is one of the most respected thinkers on free speech. Became known as an openly gay advocate as early as 1991, where he was arguably the most prominent public voice for changing attitudes and laws regarding issues like gay marriage in the States. He makes a compelling point that the progress vis-a-vis gay rights was made through open dialogue, free speech, some of it hateful, but only through free speech can hate, illogic, and fallacies be exposed. You know, he wrote this well before the Pride Society made its ruling, obviously well before the two speakers appeared. But you know what? He could have been talking to both, because the message is of value for everyone, including me. We've replaced humility with an anti-intellectual certainty and a self-righteousness that is divisive and counterproductive. Mr. Rauch in quotes. A liberal society stands on the proposition that we should all take seriously the idea that we might be wrong. This means we must place no one, including ourselves, beyond the reach of criticism. It means that we must allow people to err, even where the error offends and upsets, as it often will. I love that quote. A liberal society stands on the proposition that we should all take seriously the idea that we might be wrong. Man, have we ever lost that. Humility has absolutely been replaced with an anti-intellectual certainty, a self-righteousness, and it is divisive, and it is counterproductive, as Mr. Rausch states. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show John Johnson, always one of our favorites, and what a great week. He's chief strategist for Davis Ray Investment Counsel. John, appreciate you finding time for us, and as I say, great week. Why? Because the Federal Reserve finally took action and lowered interest rates, and I think, you know, a quarter point, albeit, but there certainly is a side that's critical of it in a, at a time when the U.S. has really strong employment numbers, their economic growth is solid, they don't have an inflation problem, and yet they've lowered rates.
Yeah, I think about it in terms of risk management. And I think that your quote of, and we can actually view what the Fed is doing and what policymakers are doing through the view of your quote of the day, that, you know, we do need to maintain a degree of humility that we really don't know exactly what's happening. The Fed has a view. The view is that things are going to be okay. This is a mid-cycle correction. It's going to, you know, cut rates 1, 2, maybe 3 times in its view. But it also, you know, seems to be prepared. It's not saying that it will do this, but the market is assuming that it's going to get pushed further and that we're going back to zero rates. So the market has a view that the Fed will push rates back to zero. That'll save risk assets and everything will just be wonderful. The Fed has a view that it won't have to do too much, and we're going to have to figure it out as we go along. But I think the fact is, for the time being, we have to take the view of what the yield curve is telling us, is that in light of everything investors know about, you know, central bank policy, bond holdings, that with the 3-month T-bill rate in the U.S. above the 10-year bond yield, the market is telling us, the largest market in the world is telling us, that short-term rates are a bit too high and they need to come down to put the yield curve back on a positive slope. And I think that's what we're going to get over the next little while amidst an economic slowdown that could turn into a recession. I'm not so sure it will in absence of a major shock that we can't anticipate. But I think that the dynamics are that the slowdown is continuing. You know, the economic numbers aren't miserable outside of manufacturing in the U.S. or most other countries. And, you know, I think that we just take it a step at a time. Short rates are coming down. And, you know, usually when the Fed cuts rates in an environment that doesn't turn into a recession, it's usually pretty good for the markets in the ensuing 12 to 24 months.
You know, it's fascinating. A couple of things that jump out right away, though, is that the credibility of the central banks. So, I mean, it's a tough word, but come on. A year ago right now, they'd be telling us we're going to raise rates 3 times to 4 times in 2019. Both central banks, ours and the U.S. I mean, they were very, very strong language, especially as we came into October. Well, they sure missed something. You know what I mean? Like, they completely underestimated a variety of events. I'm not saying they should have, but it should also remind us these people aren't the Oracle of Delphi. You know, they may change again coming up, you know, 6 months from now or a year from now. I'm just saying it's kind of interesting on that side that they got it so wrong. And now I'm just wondering, as you say, the big challenge for individuals is this stuff impacts us directly. You know, usually you and I could get together over a cup of coffee and we could talk a lot of economics that a lot of people might find, oh boy, you know, yeah. At least I'm considered the chat killer. You know, don't get Campbell anywhere near us. He'll bore us to tears. But in this stuff, they don't say that about you, John. They say it about me. But,
I'm sure they say it about me, too.
But think about this. I mean, we're talking about our interest rates, you know, which obviously is borrowing rates and savings rates. We can't forget the savers who aren't happy about this. Then we're going to be talking about, you know, the currency rates. This is the stuff that gets right down to our wallet. So, I mean, it's incredibly important to get right.
Yeah, everybody's looking for complete certainty. And I think that you and I both recognize this. You know, we've been around watching this for a long time. And I don't think there's ever been so much uncertainty about how all the pieces of the puzzle, the economic puzzle, the financial puzzle fit together. You know, the world is way more globalized. And it's actually globalization is reversing itself that we've never experienced in our lifetimes. They're still debating what happened, you know, 100 years ago or 80 or 90 years ago when the tariff wars of the 1920s happened. And they still haven't figured it out. And I suspect that 100 years from now, people will still be studying this period and trying to figure it out. And here we are in the middle of it. that, and, you know, people are making these definitive opinions. Everybody says, oh, the Fed's going to save us. We don't know. The Fed doesn't know. You know, the amount of, part of the problem is that, going back to the point you made earlier, you know, the Bank of Canada and the Fed have turned their views around. That always happens. They always go a little too far, and then they have to reverse themselves. And, you know, they look at their models, and I think that their models, which may have worked well in the past, are working less well now, because that thing that we've always talked about, that nasty four-letter word debt, has been is a much bigger problem than it's ever been before. And I don't think it was a surprise to you or I or quite a number of others, but to the majority of investors, analysts, and economists, you know, having things get wobbly with a 1.75% overnight rate in Canada, a 2.375% overnight rate in the U.S., and a 3% handle on a 10-year Treasury yield was shocking for them. If you were in the camp that there's too much private sector debt, maybe even government debt globally, you know, you were prepared for the wobbling to set in. None of us knew exactly what level, but we knew it was going to happen sooner than most others thought it would, and that's indeed exactly what happens. And they should have seen that. They have models that worked before 2008. They failed in 2008, and they haven't fixed them yet. So there's a lot of uncertainty about central banks at a time when people want the definitive answer and exact certainty from central banks. And central banks have to be careful about making these definitive statements. I'm inclined to really tip my hat to Steve Poulos. You know, he's taken a fair amount of criticism. He moved very slowly and tentatively. He spent a lot more time talking than he did in acting on rates. And that turns out, in hindsight, to have been exactly the right decision. I don't know if 1.75 is too high, but certainly if we'd gotten above 2, as many people thought the bank would, we would have a problem here in Canada as well. And right now it looks like, you know, he's looking pretty clever because he's recognized this uncertainty and he dragged his feet on the way up and he has room now to drag his feet on the way down, which is good for us as investors. I've been worrying greatly about how we will behave as investors in a world where short-term interest rates could go back down towards zero. And also, as a professional analyst, I don't think markets work at all when short-term rates are too low. I don't think they're sending out the right signals to investors and businesses when rates are at zero. It creates terribly distorting behavior, and it's going to be like we're walking through the garden and we're going to step on a rake and it's going to come up and hit us between the eyes. I don't know when, but it worries me.
Well, and you know, I'm with you, by the way, on Stephen Poulos, especially in this regard. I think he's made it clear right from the get-go he's watching the data, which is another way of saying we're not sure what's going on, or we're not sure until we see the data. I was patting him on the back for that. I was just a little surprised that they didn't get that we had built an economy, especially in the real estate sector, that was predicated on record low rates. Then the federal government, which has nothing to do with the central bank's policy, but the federal government steps in with a stress test. Then the BC government and the Ontario governments decide, no, we haven't killed the market enough yet. Let's see if we can't nail that activity with a whole bunch of taxes and other restrictions. So I was surprised that the bank didn't get that's going to be real problems. I mean, I knew it, and I don't mean in hindsight. I mean, that was pretty obvious. If the biggest motivation for getting in the real estate market are record low rates, and you've taken away record low rates with 5 quarter-point increases, and the government's then added on these regulations and new taxes and stuff. So the only thing I was critical of is, how didn't you see that coming? But I did like his approach, which said, we don't know what's next. We'll watch the data and then take action. So,
yeah, I guess, like, you watch the Vancouver housing market very closely, obviously, and it seems to be on the squishy side of things. Toronto's took a hit, too, but it seems to be recovering very strongly. Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, I'm puzzled by, and I would hope others are as well, is that they've clamped down on the proper, like the normal regulated channels of mortgage borrowing. But people are moving out into these unregulated areas, and they're paying, some of them are paying pretty close to double-digit interest rates. So it suggests that the mindset isn't just interest rate driven, and people are getting around the rules. They're willing to pay high rates because of this view that they got to have a house. And so I don't know if that's been broken yet. I think when it does break, it's going to be bad. So I think that we just have to kind of tread very carefully. And, you know, I think none of us knew what the breaking point was on interest rates. I think that Steve Poulos and many other conventionally oriented economists thought it was well above current levels. you know, something up in the high twos at least. But, you know, now we know it's not too much above where we are now, or it may be where we are now. We'll find out. But I have to admit, the Canadian economy, I'm not a big enthusiast about the Canadian economy over the long run, but it seems to be doing reasonably well.
Yeah.
And I look at North America in general, you know, it's not doing spectacularly, but, you know, we're working our way through something with positive interest rates, with proper signals to savers and investors and businesses in terms of the interest rate signals that are getting sent about capital investment and decisions like that. So I don't think it can get much better. And I think they could make it a lot worse if they get rates down to zero.
You're listening to Money Talks. Coming up, by the way, I've got a shocking stat that I want to give a guarantee. It's going to shock you. It's going to shock my technical producer, Greg Shaw. It's going to shock Michael Levy. It's going to shock John Johnston. It's going to shock all of us. Wait till you hear it. That's quite a promo. I better deliver, and I'm going to. John Johnston is Chief Strategist for Davis Ray Investment Counsel. John, let me just, and I know we obviously we don't have time. You spend your whole professional career outlining all of these things, but if I can just throw a couple of things at you, you know, let's talk about the equity markets.
Okay. I see a divergence between what the global manufacturing sector is doing, which is a leading indicator, which corresponds nicely to turning points in the equity cycle. It's pointing down. Government bond yields are all heading down to new low levels. That's a pessimistic view of things. The equity market is fairly upbeat. There's a divergence. I think equities are going to be volatile for a few months. Same thing with corporate bonds. I think once manufacturing turns up in the fall, I think we'll end up pretty well. And I'd like the cyclical sectors as a setup going into the fall. They've been there. You know, some a lot of stuff's expensive, but the cyclical sectors, the industrials, including the transports, the resource sectors, are all set to do quite well once global manufacturing bottoms. I think in the fall, and then that gives us, you know, really great returns from 12 to 24 months afterwards.
It's funny. I want to talk about commodities for a sec, but I remind myself it was like when I was 6 years old and it was the old, are we there yet? I don't think we're there yet for a commodity cycle, but I think we're going to get to one.
Yeah, I agree. I think the cycle's dominating for now. Once again, that manufacturing sector, and I follow it using the J.P. Morgan Market Purchasing Managers Index for manufacturing for the global economy. The turning points line up nicely with commodities. I think commodities have a bias to being weak into the fall. When manufacturing bottoms, they go up. It's a cyclical recovery. And I think, you know, we've talked about this in the past. When is that big cycle going to turn? We've had this long down cycle in commodities in the Canadian dollar, which corresponds to an up cycle in the U.S. dollar. And when is the big dollar going to turn down? And there are all sorts of opinions. I thought we're within a year or two of it. I think you're a bit further out on the horizon. And I talked to a really good analyst, friend of ex-RBC friend of mine, who's at Canaccord Genuity now. He thinks it could be 8 or 9 years. So I think that's something we need to watch carefully. But I do think there's a good cyclical recovery coming. And until we see signs that the U.S. dollar is breaking down, that strength in commodities, if you're overweight, is a selling opportunity or it's a cyclical trade within a portfolio.
Now, this is one of those horrible questions, but come on, let's fall asleep, wake up in 6 months, or give me another time frame. What are interest rates going to be?
I would think that short-term interest rates in the U.S. will be at least 25 points lower. In Canada, I suspect the risk environment that's getting the Fed to move may prompt the Bank of Canada to cut rates once. So short rates will be, you know, slightly below current levels. And if the global manufacturing sector is turning up, they'll hold there for the balance of the year. So, you know, current levels minus 25 points 6 months from now. A year from now, maybe a snig higher, if my view of the world is correct. You know, maybe something around the 2% mark, both in Canada and the U.S.
You've had a great record on the Canadian dollar. Can you just give us 30 seconds on it?
Yeah, given my views on the global manufacturing sector commodities, I think the Canadian dollar is biased lower through the fall. You know, we're kind of in the 75, 76 cent range now. I don't think there's a recession, so maybe the Canadian dollar breaks down below 75 cents through the fall. And then in the final months of the year, maybe I think, and into the early part of next year, I think we could go up to the 77, 80 cent range.
Mm-hmm. Well, as always, by then I'll certainly have chatted with you, I hope, a couple more times.
Yeah,
John,
me
thank
too.
You so, thanks so much for taking the time, though. John Johnson is Chief Strategist for Davis Ray Investment Counsel. Go out and enjoy the rest of the weekend. You've made ours a lot better by joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Enjoy the weekend.
Time now for this week's shocking stat, thanks to Capital One. Worrying about CO2 emissions is all the rage, like my emissions are smaller than your emissions. It's a boast that can earn big points in the virtue signaling world of climate change. Come on, just this week, Prime Minister Trudeau took it on the chin, not just for taxpayer-funded campaigning that's seen him take 5 trips to BC since May. No, the big issue for climate critics was that resulted in 20 tons of CO2 emissions. But it's so easy to point the finger. But what about the rest of us? French think tank The Shift Project has pointed the finger directly at online video streaming as an increasing source of CO2 emissions, generating something like 300 million tons of CO2 emissions a year, which, are you listening, is about 4 times more than the entire oil sands. That's right. The Shift Project study estimates that online video represents about 60% of global data flows. That still doesn't even include Skype or the live webcam girls or telemedicine, which the think tank says would add another 20% of worldwide data flows. So if you're one of those people who says it's a climate emergency, do more than talk. Get off Netflix. Get off YouTube. No more FaceTime. Otherwise, the rest of us will know you're just grandstanding with that emergency talk. But let's dig a little deeper into the report. Here's a question. Which results in more CO2 emissions? The Alberta oil sands or streaming pornography? And the winner is porn. Hands down, streaming pornography results in more CO2 emissions than the entire oil sands. But you know what? You don't see the Green Party or Gerald Butts and the World Wildlife Fund or David Suzuki, Greenpeace, Lead Now, Tides USA, Tides Canada. Don't see any of them protesting porn watching. Online porn results in more CO2 emissions than entire countries like Austria, like Chile, or Denmark and Belgium combined. So come on. If you're serious about lowering CO2 emissions, you know where to point the finger, but please wash it first. Ozzie Jurek joins me on the line right now. Ozzie, going back a few weeks ago, once it became clear that we were going to get a shift in interest rates, at least flat to down, and we watched the long-term bond market go, push 5-year rates down, I thought the bottom would be in. I still think interest rates play a major role in determining people's activity in the market. Well, I think we've started to see that. I think the bottom, I said at the time, I thought the bottom would be in because, again, it was interest rate driven. It looks like that's the case. Or am I too bold on that one, Ozzie?
I think. Well, it's certainly clear that interest rates play a role, but the big thing I think also is confidence. You know, if you have confidence in our future, then we make decisions and plunk down some money. And of course, the lowering of interest rates gives us that confidence. The thing is, when we talk about statistics, our eyes glaze over. There seem to be too many numbers. But the numbers tell a story, and the story is very interesting that July, for instance, was better than June. That's very unusual. Normally, we have the biggest market in the spring, sort of leading up to June, with June pretty good. Then we go to sleep in the summer. Not this July. We're up 23% in sales. And when you look at the single-family home sector, we're 31% up in sales, and more importantly, we're 9% down in listings. So we have fewer houses for sale, we have a lot more sold, and so clearly there the bottom has sort of taken place. And then we look at the condo sector, we're up some 15% in sales. Overall, sales prices are down between 6 and 7% on average. But we still have to remember that the big swings were still in the marketplace, and that all has to work out because the average single-family home on the west side clocked in at one time in the past in 2017 at $4.4 million. Now it's $3.3 million. The most expensive condo average was over $1 million. Now it's $657. But the bottom, I think, is in place.
Yeah, and I think people have to remember, we're not talking about some sort of V bottom, like you Z down and then Z back up. I mean, we're just saying that sort of period where every single month you were reporting worse numbers, whether you're talking about rising listings, lower prices, especially lack of activity. We're just saying that may be the bottoming phase that we're in right now. A couple of questions around that for me, though. As I say, what numbers will you still be watching closely? I'm thinking listings will tell me something. Obviously, the number of sales will tell me something, but listings also.
Yeah, no questions. I mean, if the active listings, that is all the properties that are for sale at the end of a month, if they're going up, that means that there's less pressure on the market. If they're going down, it means there's less product available and more bidding will start. So we're seeing for the first time that, you know, we used to have condo listings up like 50%, 60%. That's now down to, it's still higher, but it's not nearly to what it was. So the customer has a lot less to worry about. And when you go to Surrey, I mean, our price is only 1% lower than it was last year. Volume is up strongly across the board. And the funny thing, Mike, if you go to Alberta, you go to Calgary and Edmonton, guess what? Sales are higher, listings are lower.
And that's the key. And that's what I was looking also, is I still think you're going to, you know, we called the turnaround in Edmonton and Calgary. I know there's a lot of factors that come into it, but I think you're also dead right that one of the things that gets overlooked is it's the psychology. And what happened in Vancouver, in the Vancouver area, was the psychology changed with talk of these new taxes, you know, and bad markets, as you always say, Aussie. Markets become the stories we talk about them. So you start talking about bad markets, it begets more bad markets. Even people who are keen on it say, okay, I'm going to put it off for a little bit because I might get a better deal. And so that's the process we're in now, is sort of this balance in psychology. Is it going to turn positive again? I'm just saying that some of the super negative is out of the market.
100%, and that's why I wrote my story, which I called the "Yeah, but." Remember, I used to say, "Yeah, nice day tomorrow," and somebody says, "Yeah, but day after tomorrow is going to rain." There was always a negative. Today, when somebody says the market is still tough, "Yeah, but it looks pretty good," right? The Hong Kong thing is happening. Our story last week on Hong Kong and all that, I talked to several people saying, "So the bottom is in place right now. We have the psychology changing, and it'll put a fix." Now there's a decoupling going on, though. This is essentially a used home market. That's the largest portion of any market. We sell 9 used homes versus 1 new home. I think in the new condo sector, there's still some real problem. I mean, the market has stalled on the pre-sale side. A lot of product has been taken off the market. And by the fall, maybe the financing issues out of Toronto, the edict might be like 2008. If you don't sell 5 or 6 units a month, we're going to pull your loan. So, you know, that still has to recover.
Well, and again, it brings to the point, it's a complicated issue, but I'm telling you, it was a major mistake to do this. If your problem is supply, and that is the problem in the Vancouver Lower Mainland area, it is a supply problem. It's so blatant when you're adding 40,000 new people on average a year over a period of time, and you're not building enough. That whole problem of affordability didn't go anywhere. In fact, it was made worse. That's me saying it. Don't blame Aussie Jurek for that. I will be correct on that one. But I'm telling you.
I'm with you 100%.
Well, they blew it. They really blew it. Their ignorance was profound. Aussie, let's go to a couple of quick hot properties.
Yeah, we got some real good ones still. There's a brand new home with a rental suite in East Vancouver at $1.8 million. Houses all around it sold for as much as $2.2 million. And we have 465 acres for only $599,000. So the price of a studio, get 465 acres on your own private lake. So if you want to be a land baron, there is your chance.
Where
and
is
then
it?
We got a least expense.
Wait a sec. Tell me where that lake is, 465 acres. I could build an 18-hole golf course.
That's why you have to go.
You have to go to
Juruk.com to find out. No, but it's on a day lake near Burns Lake. So it's up in the interior. But hey, I mean, if you want to get away from stuff, there you go.
Wow. What about Victoria? I know you were telling me you got something there.
Yeah, the least expensive revenue duplex. 6 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, 4 parking spots, great big lot, income $3,200 a month, and the assessed value is $845,000, and the asking price now is only $799,900, and that looks like a smoking deal. In fact, if you go to juroc.com, juroc.com, this week seems to have been a fine crop. We have 9 properties, all of which would be labeled hot properties, meaning they're a cut above.
That's right. And then, so as he's saying, stuff that looks interesting to him, you go do your due diligence every time and make sure it fits what you're doing if you're an investor, et cetera. But always fascinating to hear what Aussie's been looking through all the listings everywhere, it seems like. He gets them from everywhere, but always interesting. Juruk.com. Aussie, go out and enjoy the rest of the long weekend.
Thank you so much, Mike. And just remember something. We've been talking a lot about statistics, and statistics are sort of a funny thing because statistically speaking, there's a 65% chance that the love of your life is having an affair. I mean, statistically speaking.
Okay, well, you have certainly stumped me on that one. I'm broadcasting. I have no idea where my wife is right now. Thanks for that comforting thought. Aussie Jerk, have a good weekend. I got a goofy coming up for you that you don't want to miss, but I've got Victor Dare on the line with me right now. Vic, I got to figure your head was spinning because I remember you going back a few weeks ago. You were telling us, you know what, you were suspecting that, man, all bets were off and you're going to have people who are playing one side of the market had to reverse and then reverse again. There's just stuff happening out there, and I think we got a great example. I don't think many people saw Trump taking another swipe at China with new tariffs. I mean, that wasn't priced into the market.
No, I think there was a lot of things that weren't priced into the market this week, and certainly the Fed on Wednesday. Here's something that happened across all markets. Volatility jumped. We've got metrics for measuring volatility. Put those on a scale, and it just leaps off the chart at you. It feels to me, Mike, when I see this jump in volatility in markets across the board, whether it's currencies, commodities, stocks, interest rates, you know, make these sudden moves, it just looks like the market was not prepared for that. Volatility jumps, and that could be a signal that we've got like a real sea change happening. I mean, just to go through this a little bit, we had the U.S. dollar surge to that is the U.S. dollar index against the basket of currencies, jumped to more than a two-year high on Thursday. I mean, gold traded through a $45 range just on Thursday alone. I think we're at a new six-year high on gold. But here's something a lot of people saw gold. But here's something you didn't see. The Commodity Research Bureau Commodity Index dropped to its lowest level in over 3 years because we've got weak metal prices. That's excluding gold. Weak grain prices and certainly weak energy prices. I mean, the crude oil market just got shellacked on that surprise announcement from the president. So there were, and I guess the granddaddy of them all for what everybody's watching, is the stock markets had been trading around or at new all-time highs, and they got poked in the eye pretty good this week, too. So, yeah, there was a lot going on. Now, here's a caveat. It is August. There are thinner than normal conditions. People are away, all that sort of thing. That may have exaggerated the moves, but still, it feels like, and I'm not quite sure what it was, but it feels like we got a signal this week that things are changing right here.
Well, again, I have to come back to something we've talked about before, but I was blown away to see every German government bond went negative this week.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not aware of another time that happened. We had talked about, you know, part of their bond, you know, the 10-year, et cetera. No, everything's gone negative there, which is a reminder to me that entire bond market is broken there. I see a monetary crisis coming up here. I think the volatility you started off alluding to is really going to be with us.
I absolutely agree. My trading desk notes of a couple of weeks ago, I had said that, you know, the stage looks to be set for volatility to jump, and that may have just been a function of volatility was so low. You know, it was like this dog has been down so long, he's never going to get up, that kind of thing. But a lot going on, certainly on the interest rate side. I think we're now over $14 trillion in negative yielding debt. That German 10-year that you're talking about is now negative a half a percent. And, of course, the Swiss, they're negative out through 50 years. The Swiss government can borrow money for more than 50 years and be paid to do it. You know, I'm thinking, if I was them, I'd take the money.
Yeah. Yeah, wouldn't you? Gosh, I wish somebody would do that for me.
Me too.
Hey, Mike, hey, lend me some money. I promise I'll give you less back. You know. Well, what I know is, as you say, the quiet trading may be exacerbating some of these moves, but there's going to be a lot more to talk about. So in the meantime, you deserve it, Vic. Go out and enjoy your weekend.
Thank you, Michael, and you too.
And you can find Vic, go to polarfuturesgroup.com, polarfuturesgroup.com. Get a chance because he gets a chance to Vic shows you what the charts he's looking at. It's a great education, by the way, also about how he looks at the market. So it's polarfuturesgroup.com. It has been quite a week. Time now for this week's Goofy Award. And let's get right to it. This is one that had, you know, when I read it, it jumped out at me and I immediately was going, are you kidding? I said it out loud when I read it. I'm talking about the invite-only Google camp in Sicily this week to discuss solutions to climate change, which brought together A-list celebrities Prince Harry, Katy Perry, One Dimension's Harry Styles. My God, I want to hear what he's got to say about climate change. Billionaires, former President Obama, who must have been slumming it in a need of an adulation fix. We are constantly bombarded with talk of climate emergency, climate catastrophe. You know, the Canadian Parliament has officially declared a climate emergency. And yet here we have these elites who took 114 private jets and a fleet of massive yachts. I mean, private yachts the likes of which none of us have ever been on, spewing tons of CO2. And they're attending the farcical Google BS fest on solving climate change. Come on, this is more than a joke. I think it's representative, actually, of a caliber of thinking. It's a lack of depth, of so many prominent people in the climate crowd. And I want to know, by the way, where are people like Environment Minister Catherine McKenna to decry this needless monstrosity of CO2 emissions? Where's the Prime Minister? Where's Elizabeth May? Climate activists are tired of hearing about this, by the way. I know that. I get the emails. They don't want to hear about the hypocrisy of climate elites like Al Gore or David Suzuki. Politicians in the Hollywood set who are all too willing to say, do as I say, not as I do. Well, I hear from those people regularly. Well, you know what? I'm tired of them. I'm tired of them excusing it. You're killing your own credibility, for goodness sakes. Wake up. So save it. I don't need the email. And keep pretending what you do doesn't matter. You're not above the rest of us. It does matter. Hey, before I go, I have an uncomfortable question. But the reason is, it's not my goofy award, but I suspect it's going to be the context for many in the lead up to the federal election. So I'm just wondering, here's your question. What's your tolerance for your party of choice to lie, to issue misleading statements or half-baked truths? Because we're going to get plenty of it. Well, we already are. It's going to be electioneering at the lowest common denominator. So I just want to know, what's your tolerance before you say enough's enough? Because this is where I part company with people who think politics first, and I do hear from them. I am not personally willing to sell out my own integrity, my own principles, for any politician, period. But obviously, a huge number of Canadians are. I find it astounding. We worry about the denigration of our political system. Well, this is where it starts. When the basis of your interaction is a lack of integrity, willing lack of integrity, you got a problem. As I say, that's where I part company with a lot of politicos. It's not an argument. I don't care which party you support. Doesn't matter to me. But I do have a problem with people who sell out their own integrity and principles by excusing the behavior of politicians they personally support. Hey, one more little goofy stat before I go. Canadian Press reports that Canada's largest daily newspaper, the Toronto Star, expects to receive $115,000 tax dollars, your money, a week from the federal government's media fund. Any way you slice it, getting money directly from the government, especially in an election year, doesn't enhance the credibility of the media, but it may improve the coverage for the governing party. That's all the time we have. I hope you go out and have an absolutely fabulous weekend. I do appreciate you listening.
Subscribe to the Money Talks with Michael Campbell podcast for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you get your on-demand audio. For the complete show, daily podcasts, and more.